Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A new Russian military doctrine, very revealing, and canceled talks between Ukraine and its separatists. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Russia has adopted a new version of its military doctrine approved by President Vladimir Putin, naming NATO and the United States as major threats to its national security. Changed portions outline the threat Russia sees in NATO's expansion and military buildup, specifically mentioning the new strategic anti-missile systems, and the alliance's move to take on what Russia says are global functions realized with violation of international law. A NATO spokesman told VOA today the alliance poses no threat to Russia or any nation, and that any steps taken by NATO to ensure the security of its members are clearly defensive in nature, proportionate, and in compliance with international law. The alliance contends it is Russia's actions, including in Ukraine, which are breaking international law and undermining European security. Ukrainian officials and pro-Russian rebels will not be meeting in Belarus' capital of Minsk today for a round of peace talks that had been scheduled for Friday. Belarusian officials today announced negotiations have broken down, but so far have not given a reason. It's not clear if the talks will resume at a later date. Talks between Ukrainian government negotiators and their pro-Russian separatist counterparts have failed to produce results so far in ending the eight-month conflict in eastern Ukraine. At least 19 people were killed Thursday in fighting with Islamist militants in eastern Libya. The French news agency says the dead were soldiers killed fighting in Sirte. Separately, rocket fire struck an oil depot in Es-Sider, starting an oil tank on fire, although officials did say the damage there was limited. Libya's government operates from the eastern part of the country after a rebel group occupied Tripoli in August. And a group monitoring the conflict in Syria says government airstrikes have killed at least 37 civilians in an area controlled by Islamic State fighters. This is VOA News. Beachside memorials, moments of silence, and religious services are being held across Asia today, marking the 10th anniversary of the Indian Ocean tsunami that killed over 200,000 people in 2004. Ron Corbin has more on the memorials and why, in spite of tsunami warning systems, residents could still be in danger.
Ceremonies marking the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami tragedy were held near a marooned Thai police boat left inland by the waves' force a decade ago. Across the region, 230,000 people lost their lives. The tragedy triggered a massive international effort to put in place early warning systems in order to prevent such a loss of life recurring. A sophisticated early warning system costing more than $400 million is in place across 28 countries. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
South Korean officials say Seoul, the U.S., and Japan have agreed on a new intelligence-sharing pact to deal with North Korea's missile and nuclear programs. Officials say the deal enables the three allies to respond quickly to any North Korean provocation during this time of increasing tensions with the reclusive communist nation. It applies to intelligence sharing only on the North's missile and nuclear progress. Last month, the U.S. Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University said prototype ballistic missiles seen at North Korea's military parades may be more advanced than earlier believed and possibly even sophisticated enough to threaten the United States' western coastline. Movie theaters across the United States were sold out Thursday as audiences flocked to see the controversial comedy The Interview after Sony Pictures rescinded its decision to pull the film. Independent theaters say they would screen the movie after a large number of chains refused to show it because of threats of violence. Robert Sinners saw the movie here in Washington.
It was funny. Yeah, I can see where people would think it was very insulting. But it was, you know, it's just comedy, so I liked it.
The Interview is a farce about two journalists recruited by U.S. intelligence to assassinate North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un. The North Korean government has condemned the movie as an insult to its sovereignty. President Barack Obama and the First Lady celebrated Christmas in Mr. Obama's home state of Hawaii by calling on all Americans to honor military members and veterans.
But the world is better. It's safer. It's more peaceful. It's more prosperous. And our homeland is protected because of you.
Speaking there to U.S. Marines at the Kaneohe base in Hawaii, Mr. Obama said U.S. involvement in the war in Afghanistan is ending and it's time to reflect on what military members and their families have given everyone else. The First Lady joined in the statement saying that American families are able to celebrate Christmas with their loved ones because U.S. troops are willing to hug theirs goodbye and step up to serve their country. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Cameroon's military has begun a crackdown on Nigerian businessmen in the Bakassi Peninsula who are suspected of evading taxes. 90% of the inhabitants of the area are Nigerians.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Bakassi. Details coming up also in the news. All 8 Al-Shabaab fighters who attacked an AU base in Mogadishu yesterday have been killed. And the Ebola-related lockdown in the northern region of Sierra Leone continues. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Cameroon, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the AU mission in Somalia says all 8 Al-Shabaab fighters who attacked an AU base in Mogadishu yesterday have been killed. A spokesman says the remaining 3 fighters were killed today. Colonel Ali Aden Hamoud says 5 AMISOM soldiers and a foreign contractor were also killed, bringing the overall death toll to 14. The identity and nationality of the contractor have not been released. Hamoud says an investigation is underway to find out how Al-Shabaab militants, who were dressed in Somali government uniforms, managed to attack one of the most fortified AU bases in Mogadishu. The Ebola-related lockdown in northern region of Sierra Leone continues. The government declared the 5-day lockdown on Wednesday to try to slow the spread of the disease and get an accurate picture of the number of cases. Shops and markets are closed, and there are restrictions on unauthorized vehicles and motorcycle taxis. Also in Sierra Leone, AP reports nurses are on strike at a northern hospital. They are demanding hazard pay for caring for Ebola patients and say they are owed back pay. It is not known how much money is involved. About 30 nurses are reported on strike at Mambenti Hospital in the town of Makini. Earlier this week, a village chief in the southwestern Sierra Leonean village of Moyamba was arrested and sentenced to 6 months in jail in connection with Ebola. Amadou Karbo was charged with secretly burying the dead and failing to report sick people to health authorities. Many Ebola cases are blamed on the unsafe burial of Ebola victims. Sierra Leone has overtaken Liberia as the country with the most Ebola infections. More than 9,200 confirmed, probable, and suspected cases have been reported in the country, with nearly 2,700 deaths. In all, nearly 19,700 cases have been reported in West Africa this year, with about 7,700 deaths. Meanwhile, in Liberia, business owners are complaining about the economic effects of the epidemic. Many say it is the worst Christmas period since the country's civil war. Also, AFP reports that a 4th member of the UN mission in Liberia has been hospitalized after testing positive for Ebola. In other Ebola-related news, the man who co-discovered the virus says Europe must consider Ebola a national security issue. Dr. Peter Pion, in an interview with the British daily newspaper The Independent, says Britain and Europe need a well-trained core of people who are globally experienced and deployable. The Belgian scientist, who once led the UN aid agency, had been critical of the initial slow response to the Ebola outbreak. He now says efforts are paying off. J. Just over a year ago, the Central African Republic appeared to be on the verge of genocide. A prompt intervention by French forces halted mass killings in the capital and violence there between Muslims and Christians or animists largely subsided in 2014. But as Nick Long reports from Bangui, intercommunal killings continue elsewhere in the country and peacekeepers cannot establish peace on their own.
The French operation Sangaris, named after a type of butterfly, was not meant to last indefinitely. There are currently 2,000 French troops in the Central African Republic, and that number will drop to closer to 1,500 over the coming months as the UN mission MINUSCA builds up from its current level of about 8,500 troops and police to 10,000. Sangaris has a battalion of some 500 men in Bangui who continue to patrol potential hotspots. VOA accompanied one of these patrols on Monday night. This sub-lieutenant is explaining that the Sangaris mandate is to act in support of MINUSCA and that normally Central Africans report security problems to their own police or MINUSCA, who then call on Sangaris when they need help. The French have night vision equipment and heat-seeking weapons, enabling them to identify and neutralize concealed targets at any hour of the day or night. Former militiamen have told VOA they are afraid of the French and try to avoid them. The patrol is now on foot and another officer is explaining that we're on a road dividing Muslim and Christian communities. He says this area was deserted a year ago, but people have been coming back gradually, and the problem here now is gangs of youths who steal from abandoned houses and sometimes fire shots to scare people away. The French government authorised Sangaris to deploy immediately after mass killings started in Bangui last December, and within 24 hours there were more than 1,000 French troops in the city. At the time, 100 or more people were being killed each day. This local community leader tells VOA the French reacted quickly to calls for help. He says you could call them and they would be there within 10 minutes. He is sorry the French troops are no longer able to deploy permanently in his neighbourhood, but admits the insecurity there is now a policing problem. Sangaris is not a police force. Violence spiked in the capital in October, but since then has been at a low level, says Colonel Philippe Testard, commander of the Sangaris battalion in Bangui.
It is the same level of violence as in our Western capitals, you know. It's basic type violence, aggressions, carjacking, attempt of killings for money and things like this. But it's only one or two per night or day.
However, inter-community violence has been on the increase elsewhere in the country. In the past week, there have been reports of at least 18 people killed and dozens injured in and around Gambula and Nola near the western border, of at least 20 killed and dozens injured in tit-for-tat attacks in the central region of Bambari, and of 28 killed in the southwestern area of Mbrez. Most of these incidents seem to have occurred in rural areas, and the figures are still being verified, MINUSCA's Chief of Staff General Frédéric Angray said Wednesday. The general says the mission has seen some graves at Mbrez, tangible evidence for the reports from that area, but the number of graves does not correspond to what was reported, and so far only 5 of the 28 alleged deaths at Mbrez have been verified. The Bambari area has been at the centre of much recent violence. General Angray said MINUSCA has only about one company of 100 combat troops at Bambari, while Sangaris also has a company in that area, but he said MINUSCA will shortly be deploying a battalion there. Asked by a journalist why the violence was continuing despite MINUSCA's presence, he said this was like expecting firemen to stop fires before they break out. A Sangaris spokesman told VOA the solution to the CAR crisis is no longer military, but involves politics, economics, security and the judiciary. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Italian Navy ships spent Christmas Day rescuing about 1,300 migrants whose boats were adrift on the Mediterranean Sea. Most were rescued off the coast of Sicily. The French news agency says the Italian Navy rescued about 1,000 other migrants on Christmas Eve. Italian officials say more than 167,000 migrants have arrived in Italy so far this year. Most have come from Syria and Eritrea and are seeking refuge in Europe. A Economists in Malawi say the country is likely to continue facing financial challenges in 2015 unless the government can regain the confidence of donors who are still withholding 40% of budgetary support due to the corruption scandal known as Cashgate. More than $30 million were looted from government coffers in the scandal, and several people, including government officials, were arrested. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The withholding of donor aid has forced Malawi's government to pass what is known as the Zero Aid National Budget for the 2014 to 2015 fiscal year. Analysts say the drop in the spending has hurt the economy. Abel Manyungwe is an economics lecturer at the Polytechnic College of the University of Malawi.
It has been a very bumpy year. We all know that we're coming from the Cashgate effects. That has been quite a major dent on the economy's performance. And you've seen that in most cases, I think very dedicated and crucial departments and service providers have been affected in the sense that we don't have enough drugs in the hospitals. I think schools, perhaps in terms of teachers' payments, is not in time.
Manyungwe also links Cashgate to the recent depreciation of Malawi's currency, the kwacha, which has resulted in strikes by various government workers demanding higher pay. For example, support staff for the judiciary have been on strike for 6 weeks, seeking a 45% pay increase, which the government says it cannot afford because it has no money. Workers at Malawi's Anti-Corruption Bureau went on strike, demanding a 70% pay raise, until the government threatened to forfeit their December salaries if they did not return. Manyungwe said the government can only avoid further strikes in 2015 if it makes efforts to restore donor confidence in the government management of its public finances.
My fear is that if we don't have this donor confidence and donor support coming back into the economy, we may force the government to go into serious local borrowing. And we may have serious repercussions in terms of inflation, in terms of interest rates, and this may have a sort of a catch-catch-rule situation.
The donors are, among other things, demanding that the government prosecute all those involved in the scandal and strengthen its financial management system. Newton Kambala is the president of the Malawi Confederation of Chambers of Commerce and Industry. Kambala says the scandal rendered 2014 as a very bad year for the business sector because of huge debts that the government owes to the private sector. He warns that if the situation persists, 2015 will be worse. In his State of the Nation address last Saturday, Malawi's President Peter Mutharika said his government is doing everything possible to address the problems caused by the Cashgate scandal.
My government has strengthened the financial system to make sure that Cashgate never occurs again in Malawi. We have resourced fairly well the law enforcement institutions, including the Anti-Corruption Bureau, so they can do a thorough job, independent, and prosecute all suspects and recover the stolen resources where possible.
Mr. Mutharika also said his government is implementing newly adopted fiscal reforms that seek to grow the country's economy by 5.5% in 2014, up from an estimated 5.0% in 2013. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
More than 20 Libyan soldiers have been killed in attacks on oil terminals by Libya Dawn militants. A military spokesman says that most of the casualties occurred last night when gunboats operated by the Islamist militias fired rockets at Libya's largest oil terminals. They're located in the port of Al Sidra. Rockets struck one oil tank, which burst into flames. Rebels also attacked a power plant in nearby Sirte. In Egypt, 8 people are reported killed and nearly 30 injured today in a multi-vehicle accident. The health ministry says the accident occurred near the Suez Canal city of Ismailia. Reports say the accident occurred when a bus collided with a truck and a car. In other news on Egypt, the military says a roadside bomb killed an army captain and a soldier in the Sinai Peninsula today. AP says the militant group Ansar Bet al-Maqdis has claimed responsibility for many such attacks in the Sinai. The militants have aligned themselves with the Islamic State group. You were listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. All eight Al-Shabaab fighters who attacked an AU base in Mogadishu yesterday have been killed. And the Ebola-related lockdown in the northern region of Sierra Leone continues. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has condemned Sudan's decision to expel two high-ranking UN officials. Yesterday, the Sudanese government identified them as Ali al-Zatari, the UN resident coordinator of the United Nations Development Programme, and Yvonne Yeli, the agency's country director. Mr. Ban called the move unacceptable and called on the government to reverse its decision. Reuters News Service says the reasons for the expulsions are not clear, but they come a month after Sudanese President Bashir al-Assad said UN peacekeepers should leave Darfur. He called them a security burden. Cameroon's military has begun a crackdown on Nigerian businessmen in the Bakassi Peninsula who are suspected of evading taxes. Cameroon gained total control of the oil-rich region in August 2013 following an International Court of Justice ruling. But 90% of the inhabitants of the area are Nigerians. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Bakassi.
Stanley Obi, a provision store owner, says a curfew was imposed in the peninsula last week following disputes between businessmen and groups of tax collectors. He says the businessmen do not understand Cameroon's tax laws.
At times you see the council will come to collect theirs. After the tax will come, police will come. You see, you are just confusing the whole system, so you don't even know where to go again. So you are just there blocked. The whole year will finally discover that all your money you've paid for the tax.
Fresh fish retailer Na Eric says since Cameroon gained total sovereignty over the oil-rich peninsula, Nigerians in Bakassi have been victims of frequent harassment by Cameroon soldiers.
It is a means of killing our businesses.
Mayor Aboko Patrick of Kombo Abedimo, a locality in Bakassi, says all people living in his council area must pay taxes as agreed by Cameroon and Nigeria in various treaties that followed the ICJ verdict.
In the Green Tree, one of the articles says that there shall be no indiscriminate collection of taxes within the Bakassi Peninsula. It did not say that there will be no collection of taxes. But the Nigerians, who outnumber Cameroonians, understood that there was no collection of taxes.
Immediately after the ICJ ruling, the collection of taxes in Bakassi was suspended. But beginning August 14, 2013, residents had to start paying their share. Amandi Kletus, who sells electronics in the area, says it will be difficult for business people to pay taxes.
We have lived here, we know the system, and we are used to it. When they were under the Nigerian system, they were not paying taxes. But in Cameroon, the tax issue is general.
Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of Cameroon's southwest region, where Bakassi is located, accused Nigerians of disrespecting the terms of the ICJ ruling by refusing to pay taxes.
On a tout simplement permis aux occupants.
He says Cameroon just wants them to understand that Bakassi is now a Cameroonian territory and whoever lives in it must pay their taxes and submit themselves to all rules and regulations of Cameroon. Okalia Bilai adds that his administration has imposed a curfew to stop people who come to Bakassi from Nigeria's Cross River State because they refuse to pay taxes.
Come
la communauté de concert.
He says the decision to stop people from traveling from Nigeria to Bakassi at night was taken after a meeting with the population following complaints that some rebels were disrespecting the maritime borders and attacking the population and refusing to pay their share of taxes. The International Court of Justice gave Nigeria a 5-year period of transition from 2008 to totally cede the disputed Bakassi Peninsula to Cameroon. As of August 14, 2013, Nigerians who constitute 90% of the 300,000 people on the peninsula had to obtain residence permit and be treated as foreign nationals living in Cameroon. Those who decided to be Cameroonians had to acquire national identity cards to be Cameroonians and respect Cameroon laws. The International Court of Justice had awarded Bakassi to Cameroon in a 2002 ruling. Nigeria eventually decided not to fight the ruling and ceded control over the protest of many Bakassi residents. Cameroon created a special committee to help develop the area. Ndobelta Bakata, who heads the committee, says they are finding it difficult to make the people feel at home in Cameroon.
Their culture is not our culture, and so they have to be sensitized. We are just trying to make them see, first of all, that Bakassi is Cameroon, but we do not force them to do anything against their will. Now we have to implement our own laws and our own rules. That is Cameroon. What we go through, they should also go through it.
Bakassi is an oil-rich peninsula and includes a very fertile area in the Atlantic Ocean. Cameroon neglected the zone until 1990 when it attempted to take back the land, and a serious confrontation erupted with Nigerian soldiers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bakassi.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you come into contact with the bodily fluids of a person infected with Ebola, you must wash with soap and water immediately. I'm Dr. Kande Greaves. The Ebola virus is only present in the blood, feces, vomit, breast milk, sweat, and semen of people who are seriously ill. The virus must get into your body to infect you. Do not touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and cover any cuts on the skin. If you are caring for someone who has Ebola, do not handle bedding, towels, or clothes that may be soiled with bodily fluids without gloves. Avoid sexual activity with male survivors of Ebola. Men carry the virus in semen for up to 90 days. Ebola cannot survive for long outside the body. Sunlight, heat, Clorox, and alcohol will kill the virus. Know the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. All eight Al-Shabaab fighters who attacked an AU base in Mogadishu yesterday have been killed. And the Ebola-related lockdown in northern region of Sierra Leone continues. Coming up, music from Cameroon. And in our feature segment, efforts to stop the transmission of the eye disease trachoma in the northern region of Ethiopia. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy holidays, Sunny!
Happy holidays, Yehias, and happy holidays to all our Voice of America listeners. Georgetown University defender Joshua Yarrow is being touted as a possible number one top pick in next month's Major League Soccer draft. The young Ghanaian player visited our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington early in the year. In this sunny side of sports highlight for 2014, Joshua tells us where he grew up in Ghana.
I grew up in Kumasi, which is in the southern part of Ghana, and it was pretty exciting. Grew up in the city, and it was a lot of learning experience for me growing up in the city. And I usually went to some of the villages and comparing both living in the city and seeing the other side of Ghana was pretty amazing and a really good learning experience for me.
Now, I know Ghanaians, as well as many Africans, they start playing soccer very early in their lives. How old were you when you first started kicking a soccer ball?
Pretty young, but I didn't really join any club till I was six. And that's the thing, because you don't have any other sports. Because people usually ask me, do you play baseball or football? And I'm like, no, we don't have those in Ghana. So you grew up pretty much playing one sport, and that's what everyone plays. And I started with, people don't get it when I say it, but it's called street soccer, where you just set up goals in the middle of like a park anywhere and you start playing. And I kind of missed that. It was pretty fun, disorganized, but really fun. And that's how I started. I went out with a couple of my friends, and then, but I didn't really look into playing soccer or joining a club till I was six.
Some of our VOA listeners might be wondering, well, how did he get to Washington, D.C.? And I guess some of the credit must go to the Right to Dream Academy in Ghana. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I got to the States through the Right to Dream Academy. And so the Right to Dream Academy is an institution that was started by a man called Tom Vernon, who came to Ghana from the UK, and he's big in soccer. So he saw the kids play and saw how talented those kids were. But it's hard because, you know, here parents would go to games with their kids and will drive their kids to practice and stuff. You don't have that in Ghana. Like, parents don't really get involved with what you do, like, with soccer. It's always the team that drives you to your game. And so he saw that and thought, well, if I'm able to get these kids the right coaching and teach them how it is outside of Ghana, like if you want to play in Europe, what it takes and all that stuff. And so he thought of starting a program that could help young Ghanaian athletes, young Ghanaian soccer players to develop their talents, and not just that, but also provide them with a place where you could get education, because that's something that's important in everyone's life. And after you're done playing, what are you going to do the rest of your life? And so he had this plan in mind, and through that, Right to Dream Academy started. And so I joined the academy in 2006 till 2010. And through the Right to Dream Academy, I came over to California to a private boarding school called Kate School, and came over as a sophomore. And it was pretty fun. And through Kate School, here I am in D.C.,
Getting back to the Right to Dream Academy, Joshua, what is the typical avenue for a soccer player that comes out of that program? Do they come to a U.S. school or university, or what are the other paths?
Well, it depends. It's because, I mean, everyone is different, and we all have different ambitions and what we want to do with our lives. Although we all go in to get into the academy, you have to be one of the top players in the nation. And after getting in, people decide, well, maybe I'm not going to be able to play soccer, or maybe that's not what I want to do with my life. This is what I want to do. I want to go to school. And so you have the option of either going and signing with the European class when you turn 18, or you come to the U.S. for high school and then through that get a good education. Or some other people end up staying in Ghana and working either for Right to Dream or with other organizations in Ghana to kind of help out with all the training that they got at Right to Dream in different ways. Others come out as coaches, others as leaders in their various societies, and so that's kind of like a path. After joining Right to Dream, that's kind of the three things you can do.
So you came when you were just a young teen,
yeah,
to the U.S., and I was reading your bio before the program, and you also kind of have a track and field background also.
Yes, that's not a thing we do in Ghana. It's either you play soccer or you run, and so, yeah, I did a lot of track, I did track in high school, and because, I mean, I thought, why not? And I went to a really small private school. We had only 265 kids in the school. And so everyone was kind of, you had to do a sport to help the school out, because if people decide not to, then the school is not going to be able to compete. And so, well, I mean, I had the speed, and so why not join the track team? And, you know, and I was really good friends with my track coach in high school. And so through that, I developed my track skills. And actually, sophomore year, I did it because I had to do, and in my school, if you're a freshman, sophomore, you have to do two team sports. And so I usually didn't do anything in the fall, and then I'll do soccer in the winter, because we play, winter is soccer season. And so I'd play soccer in the winter and then run track in the spring. And so I did it sophomore year, and I thought to myself, well, maybe I did this because I had to, that kind of thing. But after sophomore year, I was, this is actually kind of fun, because that was a good workout, and it was so much fun just trying something new and kind of pushing myself in a different way. And so, yeah, track, that was a good experience.
What events did you compete in track?
I kind of switched around a lot, but over my 3 years in high school, I did the 100, the 200, the 400, 4x4, the 800, long jump, triple jump, and high jump.
Voice of America.
If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, I'm talking with Joshua Yarrow. Joshua is a student and soccer player at Georgetown University here in Washington.
I chose Georgetown for a few reasons, obviously because it's a good school and it fits with my major, but mostly because of the coaches. I met my head coach, Wiz, and I mean, I had no idea who he was then, but through our meeting, he proved to be a really good person, besides being a good coach. And he actually asked around about him, and everyone had great things to say about him. And that's something that I was looking for, because I wanted to work with a coach that would, not just a good coach, but a coach that would understand me and would be there for me always. And he's always been with my other two coaches. They've been great in helping me develop as a player. And so the coaching staff was my kind of my final decision. And then I wanted to be part of a program that was building up, because I mean, it's easy to just go into a program that already has a good reputation and dive right in and be part of it and everything goes great. I actually wanted to be part of a program that was building up, and Wiz has done a good job in developing this program to where it is now. And I thought it would be just cool to be part of such a tremendous program, and with the coaches and my teammates came over from our official visit, loved all the guys, hanging out with them, and I just felt like part of the team the first right. day when I came on for my official visit. And then I know, and part of me is just, you know, sometimes you go to a place and you're like, wow, I really like this place for no reason. I kind of got that right when I got on campus. Like that was the first impression I got right when I got on campus. For the first time I ever came to Georgetown, it was just like, well, I could see myself here for the next 4 years, and with the coaches and everything and my teammates, did it for me. And our season was great.
Joshua, let's talk about maybe your future aspirations. Would you like to play professional football?
Yes, that's always been my dream, and I would like to do that one day. But I don't know yet, but I really want to get a degree, because always has been my dream too. And I'd want to do both side by side, and so far it's been working out because that's what I've done throughout my life, and it's been working out great. So I think, I mean, I definitely want to play, but after college.
Georgetown, well known for its academic program. What are you studying at Georgetown?
So I'm studying government in the college with a concentration in international relations.
And what do you hope to do with that degree?
I hope to go back one day to my country, Ghana, and work in the government. And it's nice because most people... Backstory, my brother actually did government in Ghana, and halfway through his major, he was like, no. Came back home one day. I was like, Mom, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a politician. So I called back home when I got into Georgetown, and was like, Mom, great. I got into Georgetown. This is what Georgetown is all about, and I'm doing this. And she finally goes, are you going to be a politician? It's like, well... Not really, but I do want to work in the government. So not necessarily wanting to go into politics, but in a way, work in the government where I can have an influence on Ghana as a society. And it's hard, and usually it's hard to get your voice heard and to get your ideas out there. But I think if I have the chance to work in the government, people will listen to me. I could use that opportunity.
How difficult has been that adjustment to both the very rigorous academic program and playing collegiate soccer?
It's hard, no doubt, but I going through with it in high school, because it was the same in high school, but I mean, not the same intensity with like practices and schoolwork, but I kind of had the same thing in high school where I had to go to practice and I had to do my schoolwork, and so I always had to find a balance between the two, I mean, for the two, and that's the same thing here. It's been not too hard. It's actually not been too bad because I was coming in. I was like, well, it's Georgetown. It's going to be extremely hard. But I mean, if you come in and you do your work every time and you go to your professors for extra help, and Georgetown as an institution has a lot of help if you need it. I'm pretty sure if I need tutors and I go to my coaches, so I go to the athletic department and tell them, well, I'm struggling in this class. Can you get me someone? Can you get me help? There will be help immediately. And that's something that helps the student athletes.
That's Georgetown University defender Joshua Yarrow, who could be the top pick in next month's Major League Soccer draft. And Joshua was talking with us at our VOA studios here in Washington.
VOA!
I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yeheus Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, efforts to stop the transmission of the eye disease trachoma in the northern region of Ethiopia. And next, women basket weavers in western Uganda. But first, some music. Here is Josephine Tanga of Cameroon with Happy Birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, so special. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Josephine Tanga of Cameroon with Happy Birthday. Efforts to stop the transmission of the eye disease trachoma in the northern region of Ethiopia through mapping and by teaching people how to apply the safe strategy developed by the World Health Organization will continue to be a major goal of the NGO Light for the World in the coming year. The organization says they have carried out mapping in the Tigray and Somalia regions to collect and analyze data that will help them effectively treat the 4.5 million people who live in trachoma endemic regions. Dr. Amir Badir Kello, senior consultant for Light of the World, explained that mapping regions is important in determining the prevalence of trachoma, which in turn allows the safe strategy to be applied more effectively.
I think the major achievement to have the trachoma situation completely mapped in the Tigray region as well as other parts of Ethiopia. The mapping was done in conjunction with Global Trachoma Mapping Project, which used standardized methodology in highly trained and qualified graders and investigators. And this is a very reliable data, and it showed us that Tigray region is one of the regions that has very high endemicity for trachoma. Almost 4.4 million people in Tigray live in trachoma endemic areas. And from the region itself, we have a backlog of over 38,000 trachoma strachatis cases. This is the late complication of trachoma, whereby you have internal lashes that scratch the cornea. And it's a painful condition that will eventually lead to blindness unless it is treated by a surgical intervention.
Given all of your efforts to try to reduce these cases of trachoma, what is your biggest focus going to be for 2015?
Our biggest focus for 2015 with regard to the trachoma control in Tigray region will be the southern zone of Tigray that has 9 of the 12 hyperendemic districts in the region. Hyperendemic means when you have very high trachoma infection rates, which are 30% and above. This would require 5 years of intervention with the full WHO-recommended safe strategy. That would mean for 2015 that we would be doing surgery for the late complication of trachoma by providing over 1,500 trachoma surgeries for next year, and also doing mass drug administration for nearly 1.3 million people living in southern zone of Tigray, and also implementing activities that would promote hygiene and sanitation in the whole of the zone.
What are still some of the major challenges that you all will be dealing with?
The major challenges are going to be achieving behavioral change when it comes to hygiene issues and environmental sanitation. These are things that one cannot implement overnight. The medical components of provision of surgery as well as the distribution of antibiotics to clear infection can be done with little challenge, but actually achieving, you know, behavioral change that would contribute positively towards improving personal hygiene as well as environmental sanitation is going to be quite challenging, in, as it requires a lot of extensive health education, provision of hardware, meaning construction of latrines, water points, but also having to convince the population to change their behavior to better sanitation and hygiene.
How close are you all to eradicating trachoma in the area?
Well, actually, we are not planning to eradicate trachoma. I think we are lucky in achieving elimination of blinding trachoma, because that is the global target as well. By the year 2020, we would have achieved our objective. We cannot get rid of trachoma as such, but we can actually eliminate blinding trachoma, meaning trachoma from being a public health problem in southern zone of Tigray region. We would say we have achieved elimination of blinding trachoma if we reach to the level where we have less than 5% active trachoma among children from 1 to 9 years old, children where we do the impact assessment, but also when we reach to the point where we only have like one trachomatous trichiasis case per 1,000 population, then we have achieved our goal.
That was Dr. Amir Bedrichello, senior consultant for Light for the World. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. In western Uganda, more than 200 women of the Rubono Basket Weavers Association are using naturally dyed raffia to make baskets of all shapes and sizes. The baskets are then sold to international markets.
Baskets have long been part of Ugandan culture, and women here still use the traditional ones known as echiwo to carry various goods. Here at Rubona Basket Weavers Association, an outlet on the outskirts of Fort Potro, Uganda, women are trained and dedicated to weaving basket masterpieces. They use naturally dyed raffia to make their products. Karen Kaganzi is the sales manager at Rubona Basket Weavers Association. She explains the process.
Out of this plant, we get maroon, we get yellow and brown. From this plant, we use the tubers, the roots.
About 200 women work here. They produce and sell about 500 baskets each month. This is a very successful project that is self-sustaining and contributes to the economic independence of the local women in the region. These women here have developed a way of incorporating modern designs into traditional basket weaving and sell their work at reasonable prices.
This is a pot basket for smaller clothes. This is a 6,000. These are penny holders for pens in the office. This is a bowl. This is for fruits and decoration. One can use it for fruits and one for decoration.
To make quality baskets, the weavers select different plants and then extract their leaves or roots. These are then dyed and dried. The weavers bring out unique colored patterns as the basket shapes from the center. A 12-inch diameter basket takes about a week to complete. The baskets are used for storage or put up as wall hangings. Karen says it took years of research and experiments until a wide range of colors were obtained from local plants. The most recent additions to the color palette are blue from the indigo plant and black from the bark of the wattle tree.
The women work in their fields in the garden. Yeah, but when they are free, when they have come from their gardens, they work on their baskets.
Oh, this is a side gig.
The project is owned and run by the local women. The income goes directly to the local women to meet their basic needs. Once the handcrafts are finished, they are carefully packed for shipping. Baskets in Uganda were traditionally used to store food and as decorations during weddings and even to ferry secrets from one woman to another. Though, through the Rubona Basket Weavers Association, these women can earn a living, but the effectiveness of the group will only be determined once they leave and put up the skills they have learned here to the test by running their own businesses.
VOA's Paul Ndiho with a look at women basket weavers in western Uganda. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the most effective ways to make life difficult for those who deliberately cause harm to others is to take away their ability to use their bank accounts or to raise new funds, and to prevent them from spending those funds still within their possession to purchase what they need to carry out their nefarious agendas. So you lock them out of the international banking system, thus taking away their ability to transfer money to vendors and to receive money from donors. You freeze what funds they may have in the banking system, and you ensure that no businesses or manufacturers will trade with them. That is essentially what happens when the United States designates, under Executive Order 13224, an individual or group deemed to be terrorist in nature or likely to commit terrorist activity, thus posing an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economy of the United States. On December 18th, the U.S. Department of State designated the Ajnad Misr Group, as well as Ibrahim Arubesh, as specially designated global terrorists. Ajnad Misr is the only terrorist group that operates exclusively in the greater Cairo area. It grew out of another designated terrorist organization, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, announcing its existence in January 2014. Since then, Ajnad Misr has been the most active terrorist group operating in Egypt outside the Sinai Peninsula. The group targets state actors. To date, it has claimed at least 15 attacks on public officials and their vehicles, government buildings, and public spaces. Ibrahim Arubesh, also known as Ibrahim Suleiman Mohammed Arbesh, is a senior leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or ACAP, itself a foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global entity. He serves as a senior advisor for the group and is involved in the planning of attacks. He has served as a senior ACAP Sharia official since 2013. As such, he provides the justification for attacks conducted by ACAP. By designating Ajnad Misr and Ibrahim Arubesh, the United States is taking a decisive step toward starving the group and individuals of their resources, disrupting their ability to execute their deadly agendas, and ensuring that they find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA.